COP23, the UN Climate Summit in Bonn, Germany. This is Democracy Now!
Keep it in the ground! Keep it in the ground!
It's up to us to keep it in the ground, and we are the youth and we are responsible for this.
Youth activists unfurl a massive banner at the bottom of the largest open-pit coal mine in Europe. The banner reads, "It's up to us to keep it in the ground." Then it's the final day of COP23.
It's been disappointing because we've seen the rich countries come again and again with the same old stories at a time when we see the climate impacts higher and higher and hitting the poorest people of the world in the worst ways, and we see no money on the table for loss and damage. We've seen that the Paris Agreement is being restricted to mitigation
we'll
only.
We'll get a roundup of the two-week negotiations from Dipti Bhatnagar of Friends of the Earth in Mozambique and Asad Rehman of War on Want in Britain. And we'll speak with a key architect of the Paris Agreement, the former president of COP20 in Lima, Peru, Manuel Pulgar Vidal. Back in the U.S., the Keystone Pipeline leaks 210,000 gallons of oil in South Dakota.
It's something that we've been saying all along as Native, as Indigenous peoples, that every pipeline is going to spill, is going to leak.
We'll speak with Tom Goldtooth of the Indigenous Environmental Network about the spill and his new report on carbon trading. All that and more coming up. Welcome to Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman, reporting from Bonn, Germany. Back in the U.S. on Capitol Hill, Republican lawmakers are moving closer to passing a sweeping $1.5 trillion tax cut that largely benefits the wealthy and the nation's largest corporations. The House passed its version of the bill Thursday by a vote of 227 to 205. 13 Republicans joined Democrats in opposing the legislation. The massive tax cut was approved without the House holding a single hearing. Hours later, the Senate Finance Committee approved its own version of the bill, but it's unclear if the Republicans have enough votes for it to pass the full Senate. One of the biggest beneficiaries of the tax bill may be President Donald Trump's own family. An NBC News analysis based on his 2005 tax return found Trump would personally save $20 million under the House bill, while his heirs would save $1.1 billion. Meanwhile, the U.S. Senate plan will actually result in higher taxes by 2027 for workers who earn less than $75,000 a year. This, according to a new analysis by Congress's Joint Committee on Taxation. A radio broadcaster in California has accused Democratic Senator Al Franken of touching her breasts while she slept and forcing her to kiss him in 2006. On Thursday, Leanne Tweeden posted a photo showing Franken placing his hands on top of her flak jacket and Kevlar vest while she was sleeping on a plane. The two were on a tour entertaining U.S. soldiers abroad. At the time, Franken was working as a comedian. Tweeden said the photo was taken after he forced her to kiss him as they rehearsed a skit.
And he just put his hand on the back of my head and he mashed his face against, I mean, it happened so fast, and he just mashed his lips against my face, and he stuck his tongue in my mouth so fast. And all I can remember is that his lips were really wet, and it was slimy.
Senator Franken apologized and called for an ethics committee investigation of himself. Meanwhile, Donald Trump has weighed in on the controversy. He wrote on Twitter, "The Al Frankenstein picture is really bad, speaks 1,000 words. Where do his hands go in pictures 2, 3, 4, 5, and 6 while she sleeps?" Trump tweeted. Trump himself has been accused of sexual harassment and assault by at least 16 women. There has been a major oil leak from the Keystone One pipeline in South Dakota. The pipeline's operator, TransCanada, says 210,000 gallons of oil leaked Thursday near the town of Amherst. It's the largest Keystone spill to date. The leak comes just days before authorities in Nebraska are scheduled to make a key ruling that could decide the fate of another TransCanada pipeline, the proposed Keystone XL. Environmental and Indigenous groups have long warned about the dangers of pipeline leaks. This is Tom Goldtooth, Executive Director of the Indigenous Environmental Network.
We just caught wind yesterday of the Keystone XL1 spill. It's something that we've been saying all along as Native, as Indigenous peoples, that every pipeline is going to spill, is going to leak.
We'll speak with Tom Goldtooth later in the broadcast here in Bonn. In international news, the World Food Program's warning 150,000 children in Yemen could starve to death in the coming months if the U.S.-backed Saudi coalition continues to block food and medicine from entering Yemen. Save the Children says 130 children are already dying every day in Yemen. Lily Caprani, Deputy Executive Director at UNICEF UK, appeared on Channel 4 Thursday.
This is now the world's worst humanitarian catastrophe. UNICEF and the other agencies, we're still there. We're still in the country, in fact, working in all of the areas of Yemen. But we can only save those lives if we can get the humanitarian supplies in that we need. And at the moment, this blockade is making that look dangerously unlikely. So we have been able to purify water to stop more waterborne diseases like cholera breaking out and deliver therapeutic food to save the lives of starving babies. But if those supplies run out, and they might well do, then we can't do that. And those children will die.
An 18-month investigation by the New York Times has revealed the U.S.-led military coalition is killing far more civilians in Iraq than it's acknowledged. The Pentagon claims its air war against the self-proclaimed Islamic State has killed just 89 civilians. But an on-the-ground investigation by reporters Asmat Khan and Anand Gopal found the actual civilian death toll may be 31 times higher than the U.S. is admitting. They write, quote, in terms of civilian deaths, this may be the least transparent war in recent American history. You'll hear the authors of that report on Democracy Now! Next week when we're back in New York. In news from Syria, Russia has vetoed a United Nations Security Council measure to renew an international inquiry into who is to blame for chemical weapons attacks in Syria. Zimbabwean President Robert Mugabe emerged from house arrest today to attend a university graduation in the capital, Harare. This marked his first appearance in public since the Zimbabwean military launched an apparent coup earlier this week. Mugabe has resisted calls by the military to resign. The 93-year-old Mugabe has ruled Zimbabwe since it became an independent country 37 years ago. In Nigeria, 15 people have died after four suicide bombers set off explosives Wednesday in the northern city of Maiduguri, which is considered to be the home of Boko Haram movement. Two of the suicide bombers were women. Human Rights Watch has accused the Burmese military of committing widespread rape against women and girls as part of a campaign of ethnic cleansing against Rohingya Muslims. Human Rights Watch spoke to 52 Rohingya women and girls who fled to Bangladesh. 29 of them said they were raped. Some of the rape victims agreed to speak on camera.
I have a younger sister. We tried to flee, but some soldiers caught us. They took us behind my house and raped us. I felt like I was dead. Then I lost consciousness.
The director of the Center for Faith-Based and Neighborhood Partnerships at the Department of Homeland Security, the Reverend Jamie Johnson, has resigned after CNN unearthed a series of racist and Islamophobic comments he made prior to taking office. Johnson was appointed to the position in April by then-Secretary of Homeland Security John Kelly. This is Johnson speaking on a radio show in 2008.
And it's an indictment of America's black community that has turned America's major cities into slums because of laziness, drug use, and sexual promiscuity.
CNN also uncovered audio recordings of Johnson repeatedly disparaging the Islamic faith.
I agree with Dinesh D'Souza, your friend and mine, who says really all that Islam has ever given us is oil and dead bodies over the last millennia and a half. And they are not our friends.
In media news, The Republican-controlled FCC has voted 3-2 along party lines to loosen longstanding media ownership rules. The vote clears the way for the right-wing Sinclair Broadcasting to expand its local TV empire. Sinclair already owns 173 TV stations. It's attempting to buy Tribune Media, which controls another 42 stations. This would give Sinclair the power to reach 72% of U.S. households. In other media consolidation news, Comcast and Verizon have reportedly both made moves to purchase the film and television assets of Rupert Murdoch's 21st Century Fox. In climate news, the fossil fuel divestment movement got a major boost Thursday when the Norwegian government announced it's considering selling off $35 billion in oil and gas stocks. Norway would become by far the largest entity to join the divestment movement. Norway's $1 trillion sovereign wealth fund controls about 1.5% of all global stocks. And the Senate Judiciary Committee is pressing President Trump's son-in-law, Jared Kushner, to hand over more documents, saying he failed to give investigators several emails related to Russia and WikiLeaks during the 2016 campaign. One email discussed a, quote, Russian backdoor overture, unquote. The senators learned of the emails after obtaining them from other witnesses. And those are some of the headlines. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. Yes, this is Democracy Now! We're broadcasting live from the final day of the UN Climate Summit here in Bonn, Germany, where all this week activists have been protesting against fossil fuels, especially coal. Well, early this morning, we drove about 45 minutes west of Bonn to the forests of western Germany. For years, activists there have been fighting to shut down the largest open-pit coal mine in Europe. The massive Hambach mine extracts an extremely dirty form of coal called lignite, also known as brown coal, which causes the highest carbon dioxide emissions of any type of coal when burned. This morning, we met a group of activists at the Sindorf train station, then followed them to their meeting place.
Keep it in the ground. Keep it in the ground.
I'm Amy Goodman from Democracy Now! Why are you doing this?
To stop RWE and such companies to destroy all our future.
Why are you doing this?
It's up to us to keep it in the ground, and we are the youth, and we are responsible for this. It's our future.
We're in Rhineland, Germany, just about 45 minutes from the UN Climate Summit in Bonn. We're standing in front of the largest open-pit coal mine in Europe, the largest open-pit mine of any kind in Europe. A banner is being unfurled. It says, "It's up to us to keep it in the ground." It's a red banner. People kneeled around it as they unfurled it. And we're in front of the Hambach mine. This mine has already destroyed 90% of the ancient forest in the area. Their point is not to get arrested, but to arrest, to stop this coal mine from operating. Tell me your name, the group you're with, and what just happened.
I'm Ira Jäger. I'm here with UNEPA. It's the Youth Network for Political Actions. And we are just here to demand the consequent phase-out of coal, especially in Germany, but all over the world, and the phase-out of all fossil fuels.
And can you describe what just took place?
Yeah, there were a few guys who went into the lignite coal mine pit, and they unfolded a very long banner, really near to all the delegates who debate over the climate change, and a few kilometers, they are destroying the climate.
Where was the banner made?
The banner was made in Paris, and it was an indigenous people banner there. And now it's, today the banner for the youth.
My name is Leah Häuser. I'm here with UNEPA.
And Leah, can you talk about why you yourself are involved? You're from this area.
I'm from this area, yes, and I know what's happening. And I woke up very late in the matter of climate issues. I come from the peace movement, and by now I see you can't separate the peace movement from the climate movement. It's the same, because the climate chaos that's already arrived is causing so much damage and leading to so much people having to leave their countries, having to leave their regions, having to find other places to stay. So it's the same like war, like everything that makes people leave their homes.
Leah Heuser and her seeing eye dog were our guides this morning. Leah Heuser is with the Aachen Peace Prize, which was awarded this year to the German group Hunipa, which carried out this morning's action. To see our full report from the occupied forest on the resistance to the massive Hambach mine, you can go to democracynow.org. Well, this is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. We're broadcasting live from the final day of the UN Climate Summit here in Bonn, Germany. This year is the first COP since President Trump vowed to pull the United States out of the landmark 2015 Paris climate deal, a process which takes 4 years. President Trump has also vowed to stop paying the U.S. contribution to the Green Climate Fund. Under President Obama, the U.S. contributed $1 billion out of the total pledge of $3 billion. Well, here at this year's COP, that's Conference of Parties, a new coalition of 19 countries has committed to working towards phasing out coal, although many of these countries, including Britain, continue to expand fracking and other extraction projects. Also this week in Bonn, indigenous groups won increased recognition of their rights, autonomy, and participation in negotiations. A document approved by negotiators this week states indigenous groups should play leadership roles in efforts to address climate change, and that countries should, quote, respect, promote, and consider their respective obligations on the rights of indigenous peoples and local communities, unquote. But many say this year's negotiations do not go nearly far enough to address climate change, especially as new research shows the threat is continuing to accelerate. New data by the Global Carbon Project shows global carbon dioxide emissions are once again rising after flatlining for 3 years straight. These findings dash earlier hopes that global CO2 emissions had peaked for good. Well, for more on this year's negotiations, we're joined by two guests. Dipti Bhatnagar is the Climate Justice and Energy Coordinator of Friends of the Earth International. She's based in Mozambique. And Asad Rehman is the Executive Director of War on Want, which is based in London, England. Asad, let's begin with you. I don't know how many of these UN climate summits you've been to, but please explain the significance of this one in Bonn, though it's called the Islands COP because it's actually being sponsored by Fiji. They just couldn't handle the number of people at the time of their cyclone season. Some people say, based on how hot it is inside, it's Fiji inside and Bonn outside. But can you talk about what this COP means after the U.S., at least President Trump says he's pulling the U.S. out of the climate, of the Paris climate deal? What's the significance of what's happening here?
So, the Paris Climate Agreement set a guardrail that temperatures had to be kept well below the 1.5-degree threshold. And we see that the reality of that because of the storms and superstorms and droughts and floods and famines that are taking place all around the world. And that's all happening at the one-degree warming. So this COP really was, are we going to see the necessary level of ambition? Are developed countries going to do their fair share to make sure we stay within that guardrail? And are they going to provide the support for poorer developing countries to be able to take the action, both to address the impacts of climate change, but also to be able to develop cleanly and not follow the same dirty development pathway? Some people called this COP the process COP, that it was setting up the conversations for next year, and that next year was the last chance saloon for keeping temperatures below 1.5. The UN Secretary General, when he came here a couple of days ago, talked about that we only have a five-year window before we have to make sure that the arc of emissions bends towards meeting the 1.5 goal. Unfortunately, we haven't really seen the kind of progress that's needed. Lots of issues have been kicked in touch, have been left till next year, which makes the COP in Poland a critical COP. It becomes the 1.5 COP. If we don't see the level of ambition, both in the pre-2020, i.e. in the commitments that developed countries have already undertaken, and a promise that they're going to increase their Paris pledges. If we don't see that, then really what we should be doing is renegotiating the Paris Agreement and saying that the Paris targets are no longer achievable. And we should be talking about either a three-degree world and the devastating consequences that will mean for millions of people around the world.
Now, President Trump says that the world should renegotiate, that the U.S. would lead the world in renegotiating the Paris Climate Accord. What do you see is the problem with that, or do you agree with him?
So Donald Trump, of course, has come here backed by his fossil fuel pals, and he's come here to wreck the climate negotiations. The reality that he would stand and his envoys would stand on a platform here with big coal and big nuclear, and that would be their intervention. And actually, inside the negotiating halls, the United States continues to block progress. It's blocking all progress on any finance discussions taking place. It's blocking progress on finance for adaptation. It's blocking progress in terms of the developed country commitment to deliver finance, the $100 billion that were committed by developed countries. It's blocking progress on that. And it's blocking progress on discussion, even of finance, in next year's COP. So whilst the United States might be saying that it's pulling out, it still continues to play a destructive role. It wants to renegotiate the Paris Agreement because it fundamentally doesn't believe in climate change. The reality is, of course, is that we have to say that Donald Trump and the US administration needs to step aside, but also that previous US administrations have been responsible for why we're in this place, in this position in the first place. If it hadn't been for the legacy of those of previous administrations, of leaving us with a weak, non-binding, non-science-based agreement, then Donald Trump wouldn't be able to do the kind of destruction that we're seeing he's trying to do here at these talks.
Explain that. Explain the significance of President Obama back to, I mean, that was the first COP we went to, and the significant COP, the Copenhagen COP. What happened there, and how you feel this is just a continuation of that, well, perhaps on steroids.
Look, when you have a problem, and a problem of the global commons, it's a problem that affects everybody in the world, right? You, what you would think would be the logical sense is you agree that it's a problem, you agree what needs to take action needs to be taken, and then you divide that action fairly. Those people who've done most to cause a problem should take on more responsibility. Those that have done less take on less responsibility. That poorer countries should be supported in terms of their ability to be able to deal with the impacts. What the United States wanted to do was rip up that agreement, a science-based, top-down agreement. And what it wanted was a voluntary agreement. Countries did whatever they could do. And that's why, in Paris, we had an agreement that was not legally binding, was not based on the science, and had absolutely no punishment that if countries walked out of it. And that's why we're left with this poisonous
legacy. Would you say it was the U.S.'s fault that this was not a binding agreement?
The U.S. led the charge. Of course, other developed countries were very happy to sit behind them. And because what they were more interested in, of course, is protecting their own economic, short-term economic interests, rather than investing in the world that we need, rather than investing in the green economy that brings new jobs, but also a right to a dignified life for all people. So the U.S. is culpable, but it's not just the United States. The European Union and other rich developed countries were very, very happy to allow the United States to be able to do that. And if they hadn't been complicit in that, then we could have been in a very, very different position than what we're finding ourselves in.
Dipti Bhatnagar, you're with Friends of the Earth. Your main focus here is the issue of climate justice. Explain exactly what this means and what's happening at the Fiji COP.
Sure. Thanks, Amy. We're looking at interrelated crises. So we see the climate crisis, but also there's an energy crisis. There is an inequality crisis. There is an unemployment crisis. So what climate justice is trying to bring the message that if we try to deal with climate change in isolation, then we ignore that the system, the current system, has also created many other crises and left a lot of people behind. In Mozambique, where I live, 70% of the people do not have a light bulb in their houses. So the energy system has not only created the climate crisis, but also has harmed workers and has actually not done the job of delivering energy to 1.1 billion people across the planet who do not have electricity. So we are trying to deal with these crises in an interrelated way, that we need ambition. We need the developed countries to cut emissions very, very urgently. But this isn't just about ambition. Equity has to go hand in hand. As Assad said, the ones that created the crisis must be the ones that address and do more to be able to deal with the crisis at this point. And the other thing is, we cannot leave workers behind. We at Friends of the Earth International are starting to find common cause
to build relationships with trade unions so that we can move together to a world where workers are not in terrible, insecure jobs, where they have also a contribution to the new economy that we build with justice.
How is your adopted country, Dipti, Mozambique, affected by climate change, and just geographically place it for us in the continent of Africa?
So we are in southern Africa, close to Madagascar, but on the mainland, we have about 3,000 kilometers of coastline, which means every fishing community that lives on that entire coastline is affected by the rising seas. We have one of the biggest rivers of Eastern Africa, which is the Zambezi, runs through the country. So we are seeing increased droughts, and at the same time, we're seeing increased floods happening in the country. And this is leading to also failing agriculture, because the people that are natural resource dependent, the subsistence farmers and the subsistence fisher folk in Mozambique, but also across the continent, are dependent on the rainfall pattern. And as that starts to change with climate impacts, their ability to feed themselves and their families starts to be undermined, and that causes a justice crisis.
And Asad Rehman, you live in London, you have for years, but you're originally from Bangladesh.
Pakistan.
Can you talk about what's happening in Pakistan, Bangladesh, India, as we deal with massive hurricanes in the United States that have meant a number of deaths, billions of dollars worth of damage, not to mention wildfires in Northern California? India, Pakistan, Bangladesh, Nepal, well over 1,000 deaths as a result of massive flooding.
Well, the consequences of the Indian subcontinent as a continent is one of the most vulnerable to climate impacts. In Pakistan earlier this year, we had temperatures recorded at 53.5 degrees centigrade. That's literally the upper end of what a human being can tolerate out in the open. We've seen super floods.
Do you know that in Fahrenheit?
I don't know that. Sorry.
It's centigrade. 120 degrees, perhaps.
Yeah. And these are affecting what is colloquially known as the breadbasket of northern India. We've seen super floods affecting Bangladesh, in Nepal. We're seeing the devastation, not just in the lives being lost, but also the damage to communities. In Pakistan, 4 out of 10 people face multiple indices of poverty, which basically means that people have barely been able to survive. These shocks of climate impacts pushes people from barely surviving into not surviving at all. The economic costs, for example, of one flood rates into about $50 billion for Pakistan. And we're seeing floods and droughts now becoming a regular occurrence. So much so that people are suggesting that the billion or so people that live in the Indian subcontinent may not be able to live there by the end of the century. And we're talking about potentially hundreds of millions of people being forced to migrate at this very moment.
For our U.S. audience, it's 127 degrees Fahrenheit, what you're talking about in Pakistan.
Yes. And remember, this is a country where millions of people don't have access to electricity, very similar to Mozambique, don't have air conditioning, aren't able to escape this kind of oppressive heat. And of course, our subsistence farmers, we have absolutely no choice but to be out in the open. The last time we had a heat wave of this kind, 1,200 people lost their lives in one city alone. So the human cost is immeasurable, but the economic cost is now growing, and the inability of people to be able to survive is being shown. What we're seeing is patterns of migration right through from Bangladesh, where you see communities being forced from their homes, people moving into the slum city in slum areas of big cities and becoming part of the what we would call the underclass, working in the precarious industries, and then men having to leave those communities and move to other cities and increasingly to other countries to find work. And that's why we see this pattern of migration of young men moving all the way through the Indian subcontinent and ending up now in the Middle East. And those are directly consequences of climate change.
Dipti Bhatnagar, can you talk about the financing? Can you talk about the Exim Bank, the Export-Import Bank, what it is and what it's doing?
So the United States Export-Import Bank is the export credit agency of the U.S. government. And at this moment, they are, among others, interested in funding the exploration and the exploitation of gas in Mozambique. So one of the largest gas reserves found in the last 10 years has been found offshore of Mozambique. And the U.S. are interested, and of course the U.S. Exim Bank is in there because U.S. corporations are in there. And it's Anadarko, which is already signing deals with the Mozambican government. And of course, we as a local Mozambican organization, which is Friends of the Earth Mozambique, Justiça Ambiental, are fighting this gas expansion because we realize that as developing countries, we also do not want dirty energy. We do not want to go down that development pathway because we see the disastrous consequences that have happened in the north and for the entire planet and for local communities because of that dirty energy. But we are asking for finance for our countries in the south to be able to go down a different energy pathway. We need renewable energy. We want it in the hands of communities.
You call it natural gas?
So the official term is natural gas, but people here at this COP have been saying this is fossil gas, not natural gas.
It's a misleading term. In this last minute, Asad, the We're Still In group, not far from us, is a major tent. I think it's financed by the former mayor of New York, Bloomberg, and it is where many groups are gathering, both businesses, nonprofits, many senators and mayors, government officials have been in there saying, we're still in. Trump may be pulling the U.S. out, but they say, we're still in. Your response?
So the real question that needs to be asked is not whether we're still in, but are we taking the action that's needed, and are we doing our fair share? So the reality is, in the land of the blind, the one-eyed man is king, and that's what is exalting this We Are In into some kind of climate leadership. The reality is, climate leadership is shown by the real actions people are taking domestically in the United States, and whether they're helping, providing the support for countries like Mozambique and Pakistan to be able to develop cleanly and for the people to be able to address the impacts of climate change. The reality at the moment is only $8 billion are in the Green Climate Fund. Rich countries, including the United States, continue to block any progress on climate finance.
I want to get a quick comment on the Green Climate Fund that you mentioned. The New York Times just had an interesting piece. The article began, a landmark pledge 7 years ago by the world's richest nations to spend billions to help developing countries tackle climate change seemed like a godsend for Kiribati, the Pacific Island nation threatened by rising seas. The result of that promise was the Green Climate Fund, but Kiribati, like many of the poorest countries most vulnerable to climate change, has yet to see any project funding. We're going to end with this, Dipti.
The Green Climate Fund has accredited some of the biggest banks that are actually funding dirty energy. We've got Deutsche Bank and those types of banks that are being accredited and receiving money for the green, from the Green Climate Fund to do projects in countries. And what we've been saying is that it needs to go to communities. It needs to go to nonprofit organizations who are actually working on the ground to build people's power. And those are the type of organizations which should be receiving money to be able to do projects that empower people and not the banks that have been part of the failed history of fossil fuels. And if they're part of the problem, not part of the solution. And if the Green Climate Fund continues to accredit organizations and banks such as those, then it's going to become part of the problem as well and not part of the solution. We need the finance, but we need it in the right hands. So this is also about ownership, not just about the changing of the energy source.
Well, I want to, 1 second, 10 seconds.
Well, look, the reality is we need trillions of finances to be able to make sure that the world is headed towards a clean, green planet. At the moment, the pledge that was given by rich developed countries, an arbitrary figure, again, plucked out of the air by Hillary Clinton in Copenhagen, was $100 billion. Of that, only $8 billion is being given. Of that $8 billion, most of it is going to the wrong sources. So not only do we need to increase the amount of money, but we need to make sure the money goes to the right places.
I want to thank you both very much for being with us on what's supposed to be the last day of the UN Climate Summit here in Bonn. Asad Rehman is with War on Want, which is based in London. Dipti Bhatnagar is with Friends of the Earth Climate Justice and Energy Coordinator. She's based in Mozambique. When we come back, we'll speak with one of the key architects of the landmark 2015 Paris climate deal, Manuel Pulgar Vidal, the former environment minister in Peru. He was the president of the COP when it was in Lima, Peru. Stay with us. Ludwig van Beethoven's Ode to Joy from Symphony No. 9 by the Berlin Philharmonic. I'll be speaking in Berlin on Saturday night. Of course, Ludwig van Beethoven was born right here in Bonn, Germany. The iconic chorale is considered a call for universal brotherhood. Beethoven born here in 1770. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. We are broadcasting live from the final day of the UN Climate Summit in Bonn, Germany. Bonn's the former capital of West Germany. It's also the place where on October 10th, 1981, Coretta Scott King, the widow of Dr. Martin Luther King Jr., addressed one of the world's largest peace demonstrations to date. As many as 300,000 people came out to call for an end to the nuclear arms race with Russia. As the climate talks wrap up here in Bonn, environmentalists and students in the United States are gearing up for a National Day of Action Saturday. The Day of Dedication protests will include nearly two dozen rallies at state capitals and city halls where protesters will dedicate time capsules that depict the current state of the fight against climate change. For more on this year's negotiations, we're joined by one of the primary architects of the landmark 2015 Paris Climate Agreement. Manuel Pulgar Vidal was the president of COP20 in Lima, Peru, 3 years ago. He's also the former environment minister in Peru, now the leader of the climate and energy practice of WWF, the World Wildlife Fund. It's great to have you with us.
No, thank you. It's a big pleasure.
So talk about what's happening here today. And of course, on this, what's expected to be the last day, we have seen all week what it looks like when the U.S. begins to pull out of a major global deal. Yeah. What's happening here?
Let me say that to understand this COP, it is really important to say that this is the real first COP in which we are working on implementation. Because the Paris Agreement entered into force just before of the COP in Marrakesh. But in this one, we are preparing all the implementation rules to have a very strong 2020 time in which the first review phase of the NDCs, the national contribution, are going to be present. So what we do expect to this COP? It is to have a clear and a strong design of the Talanoa dialogue. And let me say, Amy, to Democracy Now!, that this is more than a dialogue. What we are expecting in this Talanoa dialogue, it is to have the countries stock-taking how much they have advanced in their NDCs, their pledges, their climate pledges, and how they are thinking to enhance it. So this is the time in which we are really going to connect our global effort with clear domestic action. But that moves me to the second. What we do expect to have here, it is a first draft with the guidelines for the implementation. And why this guideline? Because remember that the first contributions or national contributions to the climate change were presented 3 years ago with no rules that had been developed before. So for the enhancing, what we do need, it is to say, okay, the next phase of the climate pledges of the countries should be based in a strong base targets, should be based in transparent processes, in reporting processes, and in monitoring processes. So the idea of the guidelines, it is to move the world toward a more strong ways to define we are going to achieve, but also we are going to define new commitments. Mm.
So what is it like this year with the U.S. pulling out? And what is your message to President Trump?
There are many things to say. The first one, it is that despite the U.S. announcement of President Trump to withdraw to the Paris Agreement, that we are still in initiative has shown that the process, it is irreversible and unstoppable. Remember, Amy, that we are still in, it is a climate action movement that it is showing that the business sector has already committed new action because they know that the only way to assure a sustainable future for the business, it is by looking to the long term. But includes, fortunately, the academia. And this is the time for the science, because if we wish to enhance NDCs, sure, we do need to have a strong scientific information and data. So to have and to engage university and academia, it is important, plus the civil society. Currently, that we are still in initiative, has already engaged more than 2,500 organizations or institutions. And it is amazing also how much the subnationals are working on that. Governor Brown from California, the governor from Ohio, mayor from different places, from the Hill, one of the member White House, among some others. So despite of political announcement, there is climate action in the U.S. And let me add something of this.
You're talking about the we're still in coalition.
We are still in, sure. But let me add this. In this COP, civil society plus some government has already committed to end coal. Because, Amy, we cannot combat alcoholism with more alcohol, as we cannot combat climate change with more coal. So what it is clear, and it was in the first Saturday before of the starting day of the COP, that the people said to Germany, among some other leaders, we do need to have a clear deadline to phase out coal. As fortunately yesterday, this high ambition coalition told to the world, we should define clear ways and time frame to phase out coal. So that is against of what President Trump is trying, that it is to go back to coal facilities. We do need to show to the world that there are no way to continue having extraction of coal and coal as a source of energy, because also the clean energy has shown to be sustainable with a good price, and it is the only way to move it toward a carbon neutral economy.
As someone who was a key architect of the Paris Accord, the year before you were the president of the COP in Lima, Peru, you know, is home to the Amazon, lungs of the planet. You were involved in shaping the agreement. In order to keep the U.S. in, and maybe you'd say some other countries, this was a voluntary agreement. If you knew what we know now, that the U.S. was going to pull out anyway, do you think that this should have been made a binding agreement?
No, I don't think so. You know that this idea, Amy, of binding or non-binding, it is very subtle, because you can have a strong international bodies that even though are not binding, are really strong. And you can have the opposite. So the issue of binding or non-binding has a lot of different steps in between. My point it is that the Paris Agreement, it is enough strong, but also we should remind that to got the Paris Agreement, we had developed before a lot of different instruments. Let me say some of them. Good science, that is a key element. Financial pledges, sure, it is important. Also, the NDCs, these climate pledges that had created before the Paris Agreement a good atmosphere of confidence, the non-state actors agenda that was really important. And let me say one more thing, political will. And in these cases, there were two political will before of the Paris Agreement. Peru, France working together. That was amazing. First experience in which two presidency of COPs were hand to hand working toward an agreement. But also all these statements of, I remember, U.S.-China, two statements, France-China, Brazil-China, among some others, saying to the world, we are will to move this forward. So if we try to replicate that in this implementation time, I think that we should and we can. Let me put an example. The next year is going to be the release, this September, I am confusing. It's going to be the release of the 1.5 IPCC report, the Intergovernmental Panel of Climate Change, that it is going to say to us, let's move the agenda, let's strengthen ambition. So that is going to be the first element for the next step.
The U.S.'s only major public meeting here was to endorse coal, nuclear, and gas with a representative of President Trump, his climate advisor, and Vice President Pence. When I asked David Banks, the Trump climate advisor, why they didn't include at least renewable energy, he said they were trying to level the playing field here. What about the U.S.'s endorsement of coal?
I think that it is against what it is, that trend. And the trend, it is to phase out coal, to adopt more strong measure of carbon pricing, to talk about the elimination of subsidies of fossil fuels, to move it toward how we are planning to incentivize renewable energy, to develop more strongest way to strengthen energy efficiency and to guarantee through different mechanisms universal access to energy. So we know that unfortunately, politically until now, the U.S. have not put on the table clear signals that they are moving this agenda toward that kind of element. But fortunately, on the other hand, what it is happening in the world with the evolving of the technology, with the dropping of the price, with records of all the time of the bidding process for renewable, is showing that, Amy, there are no way to turn it into fossil fuels because the change the world has already started to change.
You see the power of grassroots activists. You go from the diplomatic world to grassroots activism. When you were environment minister, you endorsed the Safe Southern Coppers Tia Maria copper mine, despite widespread criticism. You came under a lot of criticism then. Do you regret that decision? And do you respect the activists who were saying, no, close it?
All the time, I am used to respecting the activists, because remember that I used to be, before of being appointed minister, member of a civil society group, an environmental group, because I am a lawyer by training. Let me say that in case of this mining extractive activity, Tia Maria, the most important discussions were about how much the mining could affect the farmers' places. So what we try to do, and personally I try to do, it was to try to find ways to create a balance in between. So to have the mine not affecting the agriculture, and the agriculture also to find a way to have, because it is field of rice, to have them doing their activities through a sustainable use of water. Didn't work in sense that the mine has not opened yet. So I think that we should continue promoting the dialogue, because what we do need as Peruvian, it is to create through the dialogue ways to build consensus.
Well, I want to thank you so much for being with us. Manuel Pulgar Vidal, leader of the climate and energy practice of World Wildlife Fund, previously environment minister in Peru, also the former president of COP20, key architect of the Paris Agreement. When we come back, in the United States, Keystone Pipeline has spilled more than 200,000 gallons of oil in South Dakota. We'll speak with Tom Goldtooth of the Indigenous Environmental Network and Isabella Zizi, Native American activist with Idle No More from Richmond, California, home of Chevron. Stay with us. Finale of Ludwig van Beethoven's Ode to Joy from Symphony No. 9 by the Berlin Philharmonic. Again, Beethoven born here in Bonn, profoundly deaf when he composed Beethoven's Ninth, his final complete symphony. After the premiere performance of the piece, he had to be turned to see the thunderous applause from the audience, which he couldn't hear. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. We are broadcasting live from the final day of the UN Climate Summit here in Bonn, Germany. Back in the U.S., in South Dakota, the energy company TransCanada says it shut part of its Keystone One pipeline Thursday after a rupture spilled 210,000 gallons of oil in a field near the small town of Amherst in the northeastern part of the state. The pipeline carries a highly polluting form of oil called diluted bitumen from Canada's tar sands region in Alberta to refineries as far away as the Gulf of Mexico. According to the Natural Resources Defense Council, the Keystone Pipeline has been plagued by spills with 35 incidents in the U.S. and Canada during its first year of operation alone. Documents obtained by DeSmog blog reveal one section of the pipeline was 95% corroded. The spill comes just days before Nebraska's Public Service Commission set to decide whether to approve TransCanada's proposed expansion of the pipeline, the Keystone XL, which was canceled by President Obama following a massive multi-year campaign by environmentalists and indigenous activists, only to be revived by President Trump. All this comes as a new report is exposing the dangers of carbon trading, a scheme in which major companies purchase carbon credits from countries who agree to plant trees or protect existing forests. Critics say carbon trading amounts to paying to pollute. For more, we speak with the co-author of the report. It's called Carbon Pricing, A Critical Perspective for Community Resistance, Tom Goldtooth, Executive Director of the Indigenous Environmental Network, member of the Diné and Dakota Nations. We're also joined by Isabel Azizi from Richmond, California, home to a massive Chevron oil refinery. Chevron said it'll purchase carbon credits to offset increased pollution from a recent expansion of the Richmond refinery. We welcome you both to Democracy Now! Tom Goldtooth, there is so much to talk about. But first, this report you've put out on carbon pricing, what are your major concerns? And right before you answer that, you just heard about the Keystone spill in South Dakota. You were one of the leaders in fighting the Keystone XL. You finally prevailed after years pressing President Obama. Trump has reversed this. What's your response to South Dakota right now?
Well, you know, with the solidarity between the tribes and the prairie land, the traditional society, spiritual leaders, our women, our youth, our grassroots, non-native, the Cowboy Indian Alliance, we stopped it three times. And as you said, we're under a different administration.
Explain the Cowboy Indian Alliance.
The Cowboy Indian Alliance is that it's about political power, bringing the native indigenous people's voices together on a long history of fighting for our treaty rights, and with the colonial government of U.S. basically continuing to ignore. So on these issues of extractive industries like fossil fuels, it's a political issue. So how do we get political strength? And one of those strategies we use is form unification, solidarity with the private landowners, the ones who live out there as well that understand the importance of environmental protection. So how do we use these issues to break down racism that keeps us divided? So we formed the CIA, Cowboy and Indian Alliance, working in mining issues in Wisconsin, in South Dakota with uranium issues, and now with pipelines.
The report that you have just put out.
Well, this is one of the issues that's very dear to us, not only in the North, in U.S., Alaska, Canada, but also our brothers and sisters of the Global South. The Sarayaku, for an example, in the Ecuadorian Amazon, where oil concessions are there. So this issue of oil and how do we strategize to keep fossil fuels in the ground, provide and prevent these destructive pipelines. Every pipeline is going to leak. We know that. And that's evident in this issue with the Keystone, first Keystone pipeline, where it's very corrosive. So we're looking for real solutions here. We've been here constantly since 1999. And our articulation throughout those years, again, is looking at real solutions. And this whole market regime is very serious to us. Coming out of the Paris Agreement, that agreement is nothing but a trade agreement, nothing more. And it privatizes, commodifies, and sells forests in these carbon offset schemes, and they're fraudulent in a system that allows the polluters off the hook. And that's why we continually organize and educate people in these hallways, but also back home, on how we need to reject these fraudulent schemes. That it also is a process of privatizing air, the atmosphere, which is a violation of the indigenous worldview, the cosmovision, is selling air, selling water, privatizing the whole Mother Earth.
Isabel Azizi, how does the story of your town, your city, Richmond, California, fit into carbon pricing?
So in Richmond, California, there's the Chevron refinery. And so the Chevron refinery actually does extract oil from the crude down in the Amazon and also tar sands up in Canada and in our First Nations territory and indigenous territories like the Sarayaku down in the Amazon. And so with our policies in California, you know, there's the cap and trade bill that Jerry Brown had passed. And that really permits us and any of the refineries to, you know, put a cap, and it's all the offsets that are being done down in the Amazon. You know, they're continuing to extract and emit fossil fuels in our towns, and it's directly impacting us as Indigenous peoples, people of color, low-income communities like Richmond.
You're a member of what tribe?
I'm a member of the Northern Cheyenne, Arikaraa, and Muscogee Creek.
Now, explain this, because you both have called this paying to pollute. What happens, what does Chevron do in Richmond and then offset it by what they do, for example, in Ecuador or Brazil? I don't think most people can understand this.
What's happening is that Governor Jerry Brown is continuing to implement climate legislation in the state of California that has four provisions of carbon offsets. One of those is jurisdictional red, reducing emissions from deforestation and forest degradation. One of the areas and the regions they're looking at is the state of Acre, Brazil. And in this case, and this carbon offset regime at the state level or subnational level of California, which is their main objective, is that it will allow polluting industry like Shell, for an example, that operates refineries in Martinez, California, or Chevron in the community of Isabella, to continue to pollute with no plan to decrease emission, creating respiratory illnesses. So this scheme has a local toxic hotspot scenario with it. So in this process, Chevron does operate a carbon offset project called RED in the Atlantic Forest of Brazil. And they have the Green Police, the Green Forest, that is a police system that basically has a history of shooting at local forest-dependent communities that try to come into their forest for subsistence. So there's human rights with these issues that we're trying to lift up. And that's why we published this carbon pricing publication.
I wanted to quickly ask you about what happened on Saturday. Jerry Brown was speaking, a part of the We're Still In coalition. Many Native Americans disrupted the California governor here in Bonn, calling on California to ban fracking. The protesters kept yelling, "Keep it in the ground." This was Jerry Brown's response.
Yeah, I wish we could have no pollution, but we have to have our automobiles.
In the ground.
I agree with you. In the ground. Let's put you in the ground so we can get on with the show here.
The rest of the
anyway.
Show.
She can take it.
So they called, "Keep it in the ground," the protesters. Both of you were there chanting. And Jerry Brown said, "We'll put you in the ground." He later told me this was just a joke. Your response, Tom Goldtooth and Isabella?
That was definitely not a joke, because in reality, slowly we are being put into the ground with the cap and trade and with the offsets that are happening. It's directly impacting our health. They're commodifying our air, our right to breathe. And, you know, that is slowly killing us. You know, we have these autoimmune diseases. We have these cancers, these birth defects that are happening. And that's not right for a governor to say that.
10 seconds, Tom Goldtooth.
Well, we have earth defenders, water protectors, you know, like Bertha in Honduras. We submitted a report to the Honduras delegation called the Dam Report. But these are earth protectors, as you know, water protectors on the DAPL. So we are here to defend them as well.
We have to leave it at that. Tom Goldtooth of Indigenous Environmental Network and Isabella Zizi of Idle No More. That does it for our week of broadcasting from here. Special thanks to our crew here in Bonn.
Sean Russell, and I'm working with AP, and I do the lighting and cameras.
Hi, I'm Jenny. I've been doing sound.
Hi, I'm Kiri from AP in London.
Hi there, I'm Julian Jones.
David Pentlow from near Oxford.
I am Sheila Nicol-Kesar.
Zoran Jankovic.
My name's Callum Skidworth.
I'll be speaking in Berlin on Saturday night at 7:30 p.m. at the Festsaal Kreuzberg. Check our website. Democracy Now! Produced by Mike Burke, Renee Feltz, Dina Gusder, Nermeen Sheikh, Carla Wills, Laura Gattis-Diener, Sam Alkoff, John Hamilton, Ravi Karan, Hani Masood, Tarina Nadura. I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks so much for joining us.